Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. While you're finding that text, let me just share with you a little bit of what we're doing in this church in case you might be visiting. We're studying this great subject called faith. And we're using Hebrews chapter 11 as kind of like our basis of this. And we've been talking about what faith is and how it affects us and what it can do for us. And this is actually, I think, the third or fourth sermon in this series. But so far we've discovered that faith, basically, another word for faith is trust. Faith is simply trusting God to the point that we're willing to be what He wants us to be. We're willing to do what He wants us to do. We're willing to go where He wants us to go. That's what faith is. We've also discovered that everybody's born with a little measure of faith, and it's what we do with that faith that determines what's going to happen to us. Now, if we use that faith, we can become great men and women of faith, and we can be people full of faith. If we don't use that faith and exercise that faith, we will eventually lose that faith. We found out also that when you start exercising that faith, the devil goes to work. He's going to do everything he can to stop you from really growing and being what God wants you to be. So you can expect that. Abel had that. Job had that. Moses had that. All of them. Abraham had it. Even this man Noah, we're going to talk about today, had it. But exercising this faith can make something great in you. And last week we talked about the man Enoch and about how this man at 65 finally made a commitment to Christ and he walked with Jesus. And by walking with Jesus, he eventually became fit for heaven. In fact, the Bible says he was translated. He didn't see death. And you know, I really believe that in the last days, and I think we're close to it, there are going to be a group of people that will be like Enoch. They'll walk so close to Jesus that Jesus can pour out His Holy Spirit and use them in a mighty way. And out of that, there's going to be a large group of people that are going to be taken to heaven and they'll never see death. I'd like to be among that group, wouldn't you? But whether I am or not, it doesn't make any difference because I'm going to be there. But today we're going to take a look at another one of these men. By the way, the thing that made Enoch, and I want to make this clear, is that his walk consisted of four things. Remember we talked about last week? The four things that Enoch did was, number one, is he talked to God every day. And we talked a lot about, we call it prayer today, but prayer is just simply talking to God. Second thing is that he spent time studying God and discovering everything he could about God. And today we do that by studying our Bibles or other good things. Third thing is that he fellowshiped with other Christians. There were other Christians around. And they did get together and they worshiped and they fellowshiped and they prayed together. You know, we need that fellowship. And last but not least, when God spoke and gave directions, Enoch did it. And to me, this is the basis of the whole thing. You know, it's so easy to say you're a Christian, but actually to do what God wants you to do is sometimes very difficult, isn't it? And that leads us to the story we want to look at this morning here, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. I want to read it to you out of the New Living Translation. It says, "It was by faith that Enoch built an ark to save his family from the flood. He obeyed God, who warned him about something that had never happened before. By his faith, he condemned the rest of the world and was made right in God's sight. By faith, Noah built an ark to save his family from the flood." When you go back into the book of Genesis and you start reading about what happened there before the flood, you'll discover that, one of the best books you can read on that is this book called Patriarchs and Prophets. And you might, this afternoon, you might want to take and read the story of what was like before the flood. It is something else. Now, let me just, a little bit here, try to explain to you what it was like. When it comes to physical beauty, the earth was outstanding. They had these rolling hills and these valleys and the hills were topped by groves of majestic trees, some of the huge trees, and some of the, some of the wood in the trees was almost as hard as stone. But it was fantastic, the scenery. The valleys were covered with a beautiful green carpet, and they were sprinkled with thousands of beautiful flowers. And all the smell, the perfume from those flowers just wafted across the air. And it was a beautiful place. You talk about fruit trees. Man, they had thousands of different kinds of fruit there. It beats what we have today, hands down, but they just had fruit and jewelry and riches. All the gold was and the silver was there just for the taking, and some of the beautiful jewelry. This is what it was like physically. In fact, how would you describe it? Well, it's probably like Fallbrook in the spring, you know. Beautiful. You look out. The other day we were sitting out here and looked across and said, oh man, this is a beautiful place, you know. Maybe it's like Butchert's Garden. You ever been to Butchert's Garden up there? I'm telling you, I looked for a weed in that place. I couldn't find a single weed. I looked. But that's what it was like physically. Hardly any signs of decay. But morally and spiritually, the world was bankrupt. What had happened is that in their lust for life, the people had turned their backs on God. And you know, the Bible is pretty clear that when you turn your back on God, you're going to worship something. And the Bible indicates that what transpired is that they made gods of silver and gold and wood and stone. And they gave to these fake gods their own frailties. And as you know, the Bible tells us that, last week I shared with you this little adage. It says, beware of what you set your eyes on, because eventually you're going to get it. Well, they set their eyes on all these false gods, and they began to operate and act like they're false gods. And the moral conditions of the world at that time were down at the bottom. It was survival of the fittest. I mean, if you were strong enough and you wanted something your neighbor had, you took it, even if it was his wife. There was no justice. They did have religious services, but their religious services had degraded to the point where they were just orgies. You know, polygamy, homosexuality were rampant in the land. It was dog eat dog. Cruelty to animals and cruelty to mankind, such as we cannot describe. It got so bad they were actually having human sacrifices to appease their fake gods. This is what it was like back in those days. Kind of like what it is today, isn't it? But you know, the Bible tells us that, you know, God sees everything. He knows everything that's going on. And over here in Genesis chapter 6, we find that God looked down on this situation. He saw it all. It says, he saw them marrying and giving in marriage and the way they were living and acting. And then God said, verse 3, my spirit will not put up with human for such a long time. For they are only mortal flesh. In the future, they will live no more than 120 years. God saw what was going on. One of these days for a Sabbath, we're going to have a real treat. We're going to see this picture called the Pineapple Story. You'll love it. But in the Pineapple Story, it's a sermon. But boy, when you get done, you will learn a lot from that. I'm just telling you, you don't want to miss it. You want to miss today. Don't miss the Pineapple Story. But any rate, in the Pineapple Story, all of a sudden, some of these natives down in New Guinea, they catch a vision of who God's like, and they ask, can God see in the dark? And the missionary says, yeah, God sees in the dark. He says, oh, we're in trouble. You know? Well, God sees everything. He knows the end from the beginning. He knows everything. And he finally said, I'm not going to take this anymore. He drew a line in the sand and said, I'm going to give them 120 years. And then I'm going to take care of this problem if they don't do something about it. And you know, it's interesting. When God begins to work, he always seeks, I don't know why, but he wants to work through people. And he looked around and he found a man, and his man's name was Noah. Now, you know, there were Christians back in those days. People who stood for right. Enoch, you remember, he was translated. We talked about him last week. And then Enoch had a son by the name of Methuselah. And Methuselah had a son, and then his son had a son, and his son's, Methuselah's grandson was Noah. Someplace along the line, Noah made a decision to totally trust his life to the Lord. And when you do that, all of a sudden it's like your eyes are opened up, and Noah began to see what was going on in this world, and he became very concerned about it. And one day, as Noah was talking to God about the situation, God talked to him. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'm going to give you my rendition of it, okay? Here's Noah, and he's praying. He's saying, God, you know, this world is really in bad shape. These people, they live like animals. They're acting like animals. He said, God, are you ever going to do anything about it? And God all of a sudden speaks and says, Noah, yes, Lord. I am going to do something about it. In fact, in 120 years from now, I am going to take care of this problem, but I got a job for you to do. Yeah, Lord, what is it? I want you to build a boat. A what? A boat. A what, Lord? A boat. What's a boat? Here's the plans. Now, up until that time, there'd never been any flood or anything like that, you know. Here's the plans. What in the world is this, Lord? It's a boat. Why do you want me to build a boat, Lord? There's going to be a flood on this world. A what? A flood. What's a flood, Lord? Well, there's going to be water coming down from the sky, and the fountains of the deeps are going to break loose, and this world is going to be totally covered by water, and I'm going to get rid of all this sin and this corruption, and this boat is going to be your salvation. Are you sure, Lord? Well, the Bible says that Noah, by faith, built an ark to save his family from the flood. He obeyed God, who warned him about something that had never happened before. And by faith, he condemned the rest of the world and was made right in God's sight. By faith, he stepped out and said, okay, God, if this is what you want me to do, I'm going to do it. And he started building a boat. And do you know something? He put all of his resources and his assets and everything into building that boat. For 120 years, he built in that boat. When he first started building on the boat, everybody came around. They wanted to see what was going on, you know. And there was huge crowds that would gather around, and Noah would build in the boat. And then he'd tell them, look, folks, in 120 years, there's going to be a disaster on this earth. Your ticket for getting out of this whole disaster is get in this boat. And you know, people made decisions for Christ, seemingly made decisions. There was a lot of people that went to work on that boat, but as the time went along, they lost heart. And then the radicals and the so-called religious right, they began to attack Noah. And I can just imagine some of them saying, you know what's wrong with Noah, these religious right? You know, by the way, there were other people there that really claimed they worshiped God. They said, well, the reason they had these little idols was so they could better understand God. But they said, you know what's really wrong with Noah is that when he was little, he slipped in the bathtub. And he hit his head and almost drowned. And that's why he wants to build this boat. And someone else probably said, you know what? This guy is really nothing but a religious nut. He claims he has in connection with God. Hey, look, you take a look at this world. Has this world changed any yet? You know, he's been working on this boat for over 25 years. And has anything happened? No, nothing's happened. The world is still just as beautiful and gorgeous. And nothing's going to happen. Don't listen to this guy. He's a crazy nut. Well, after a while, the crowds got less. The people that came to work on the boat dropped off. And after 120 years, only Noah and his family were left to finish up the project. And as you read the story, you discover that after 120 years, there were some dramatic things that took place that should have warned the world. All of a sudden, they saw all these birds and all these animals coming toward the ark, two by two. But they even had an answer for that. I said, oh, this is just a strange phenomenon. There's nothing to it. But you know the rest of the story. Noah and his family, after he gave his final message, he and his family got on board that boat. The Lord closed the door of the ark. And after 7 days, it started raining. And the fountains of the deep were broken up. And within 40 days, this earth was totally inundated with water. And anything outside that ark died. That's the story. It says, by faith, Noah built an ark to save his family from the flood. He obeyed God, who warned him about the something that had never happened before. By faith, he condemned the rest of the world and was made right in God's sight. That's Noah. Now, what we want to do with this story as a background is I want to take a look at it, and I want to talk a little bit about, first of all, let's talk about the situation that was back in those days. Then we want to talk about God. And we want to talk a little bit about Noah and his response to God's call. And then we want to talk about the boat. I really want to spend some time talking about the boat, because I think all of us have boats that God has asked us to build. First of all, the situation. It was bad news. But you pick up any newspaper today and you watch television, and it isn't long, it becomes very clear that what happened back in those days is happening again. You know, I used to be a television junkie, but boy, I can hardly stand to watch it anymore. You know that? There is so much crud and corruption, and some of it's just downright stupid. You know that? And I was reading the other day, not too long ago, in a Newsweek magazine, that basically what's happening is that, you know, Hollywood is dictating the morals of the world today. Did you know that? They're dictating, and they have their own ideas of morals. And they're going to bring everybody down to their level. And the way they're doing it is that they're just putting it in all these television programs and so forth. Did you know that over here in Romans chapter 1, starting with about verse 18, we won't go through it all, but Romans chapter 1, starting with verse 18, we find that there are seven steps that lead to immorality and destruction. Seven steps. Now, the first one is turning your back on God. That's where the problem starts. We won't go through them all, but I want to just read to you, starting with verse 26 and reading to verse 32. I just want to read it to you rapidly, because here are the last three steps, and notice what they are. That is why God abandoned them to their shameful desires. Even the women turned against the natural ways to have sex and instead indulged in sex with each other. And the men, instead of having a normal sexual relationship with women, burned with lust for each other. Men did shameful things with other men, and as a result, suffered within themselves the penalty they so richly deserved. When they refused to acknowledge God, he abandoned them to their evil minds and let them do things that should never be done. Their lives became full of every kind of wickedness: sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, fighting, deception, malicious behavior, and gossips. They are backstabbers, haters of God, insolent, proud, and boastful. They are forever inventing new ways of sinning and are disobedient to their parents. They refuse to understand, break their promises, and are heartless and unforgiving. They are fully aware of God's death penalty for those who do those things, yet they go right ahead and do them anyway. And worse yet, they encourage others to do them too. The last three steps. So, Redness, what do you think? Hey, folks, I want to tell you, I think we're down there in the last three steps. We're there. In the last 50 years, or the last 60 years, I've seen the morals of this country just go down like that. The devil is alive and well, and he's trying to take the world over. But I want to tell you something. God knows what's going on. And God has a master plan for this world. And just like he had a plan for Noah's time, he's got a plan for today. And God's plan is right on target. Folks, whether we like it or not, one of these days, God is going to come back to this earth and he's going to take care of the situation. He is going to set this world straight. He's going to eradicate sin and he's going to get rid of Satan. Satan is not going to only go out of business, he's going out of existence. Now, I don't know when Jesus is coming back. But what I do know is that he is coming back. And I know that there are certain things that are going to take place. Now, over here in Daniel chapter 11, and I'm not going to read all this, but I want you to notice this, because this is an eye-opener. Daniel chapter 11. And we're just going to start with verse 40. I'm just going to read a little bit of it just to whet your appetite. When you go home, you want to read Daniel 11. Start with verse 40 and read down to chapter 12. But just listen to this. Then at the time of the end. Did you catch that? Let's talk about the end times. The king of the south will attack him. And the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots, cavalry, and a vast navy. He will invade various lands and sweep through them like a flood. He will enter the glorious land of Israel, and many nations will fall. But Moab, Edom, and the best part of Ammon will escape. He will conquer many countries, and Egypt will not escape. He will gain control over the gold and the silver and the treasures of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will be his servants. But then news from the east and the north will alarm him. He will set out in great anger to destroy as many as he goes. He will halt between the glorious holy mountain and the sea. He will pitch his royal tents there, but while he was there, his time will suddenly run out. There will be no one to help him. And verse 12, chapter 12, verse 1 says, and at that time, Michael the archangel, who stands guard over your nation, will arise. And there will be a time of anguish greater than any since nations first came into existence. Did you catch that? Go home and read it. Study it. Folks, we could be living right down at the very end of time. The time of the end is talking about here. Just read it. I don't know the answer. You know, I'm open. I know that God has a plan. I don't think any of us fully understand his plan, but God is coming back soon. And you know what's interesting about this is that before God ever does anything great, do you know he always makes sure that people know about it? And guess who he uses to announce it? Us. People who have made decisions for him. Those are the ones that God works through to warn the world. You see it over and over and over and over again in the Bible. We are God's plan. What happened to Noah is what God wants to happen to each one of us here. We are to become Noahs in our own right. It's our job to help people to understand. And folks, I want to tell you something. We are the only plan that God has. I heard this little cute story that it was Jesus and Gabriel, and they were walking in heaven there, and they just finished up the New Jerusalem, and they were looking it over, and Jesus was showing all these great things to Gabriel, and suddenly Gabriel said to Jesus, man, this is a huge city, but how are you going to fill it? Oh, he says, I have a plan. What's your plan? He says, I've got my people. My people are going to tell other people about me. And about what's going on. And they're going to warn it. And other people are going to make decisions. And they're going to tell other people, that's my plan. They walk along in silence. And suddenly Gabriel leans over and says, but Jesus, what happens if your people don't do what you ask them to do? Do you have a backup plan? Jesus doesn't say anything for a while. And suddenly he turns to Gabriel and he says, no, I don't have a backup plan. My people are my plan. Folks, we are God's plan. God has a work for us to do. And God is going to come back whether we are ready or not, but He wants us to be involved in it. He wants us to be saved. Now, the plan is in here. Now, we're the ones that make the decision as to whether we're going to go by God's plan or not. It's not enough just to say, I'm a Christian. No, we have a lot of head knowledge today, but we need more of a heart relationship. This amounts to coming to the Lord and saying, okay, Lord, I want you to be the boss. I want you to take over. I'm willing to be what you want me to be. I'm willing to do what you want me to do. I'm willing to go where you want me to go. That's what God is looking for. And when God finds that, He begins to work His plan in that person's life. And that person will eventually grow up and become like Enoch, or like Joseph, or like Abraham, or even like Noah. God has a plan, but He wants His plan to be my plan. Now, it's interesting, as I've read my Bible, I discovered something very fascinating. I discovered that God's plan for us is to live long, happy, healthy, fruitful lives, and have the promise of life everlasting. As I've read my Bible, I've come to the conclusion that God's plan is for His people to live in this world society, to live at least 120 years. Did you know that? 120 years. I'm 65. I'm going to live another 55 years. You know? I don't know whether I want to. But at any rate, God has His plan. He has a plan for me. He has a plan for you. And that brings us to Noah. We have to come to the place where we're willing to be like Noah. And when God speaks to us and says, okay, I want you to go do something, we got to step out and say, okay, Lord, I'll do it. And God sometimes speaks to us in strange ways. Not sometimes, He doesn't always come to us audibly, but God will say, okay, now, Burton, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, I want you to... And you know, I still got a hard head. You know, they say that there's three kinds of people in this world. Those who learn from other people's mistakes, those who learn from their own mistakes, and those who never learn. You know? And boy, I'm telling you, I'm learning. But God's master plan has to be carried out in our lives. And that master plan calls for it ultimately to have the promise of everlasting life. Now, God's plan for Noah was to build a boat. He'd never seen a boat before. God gave him the plan. Now, God was the master architect. And He showed him exactly how to build this boat. He said, you build it in detail, just like this. You put it all together like this. And Noah became the builder. He was the general contractor, but God was the master architect. And Noah built that boat. And he never stopped until it was finished. Now, it wasn't easy, as I mentioned. Noah had all kinds of criticism. You know, he had a lot of heartaches. He wasn't a perfect man. He made his mistakes, but one thing he did is he stayed with God until he saw it finished. And that boat was the saving of his family. Now, I really believe, and that brings us to the boat, and I really believe that this boat is vital that we look at it. First of all, if you take this book, you discover that it mentions that the boat basically is a relationship with Christ. If you have that relationship with Jesus Christ, you're going to make it. No matter what happens, you're going to make it. If you don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, you will not make it. The boat is Christ. But as I've looked at this, I've come to the conclusion that God gives each one of us a project. I don't know what the project is for you. I don't know what He wants you to do. But He wants you in some way to build a boat that will draw people to Him. Whatever it is, God has a plan. And He wants you to be involved in it. Now, I don't know what His plan is for you, but let me just share with you very quickly exactly what I feel God's plan is. Has been for us. This morning I told quite a bit of the story that I'm going to cut it down some because our time is running out. But let me just tell you, In the ministry, I have been very, very, very frustrated. The thing that frustrates me about being a minister is that as the churches grow, I get tireder. It wears me out. I told him about in the early service about how the Lord took us to this magnificent church, brand new church, something like this one. And you know, I had about 300 members when I first went there. And within 3 years, we had over 500 members in that church because, you know, I knew how to pray and I taught these people how to go out and bring people to Christ. But there was a problem there. And the problem basically was me and my way of thinking how I should pastor. You know, when I first went to that church, I was sticking 300 bottles in babies' mouths, you know, going around, and everybody would call me up and say, oh, man, I was going around trying to solve all these problems, 300 problems. And when I left there, I was going around sticking 500 bottles in people's mouths, you know? I was exhausted. I hated to hear that phone ring. Anytime anything went wrong, the phone rang, you know? Even today when I hear a phone ring, I cringe. I thought, there's got to be a better way to pastor than this. This is a problem. Started me on a search. I wanted to find out how I could be a better pastor. Went to all kinds of seminars. I became a seminar junkie. I'm telling you, man, if there was a seminar on church growth, I was there. Man, some of them were good, but most of them, you know. But that's just the way it is. You know, I was looking. But there was one seminar that all of a sudden, as I sat in a seminar, the light went on and I got the answer. And I found my boat. It was in Modesto, California. First Baptist Church. The minister's name was Yeager. And Yeager had been a chief, I don't know, he's in the Navy. He's an E-9, whatever that is. Master, whatever it is. But he had gotten out of the Navy, become a Christian, and too bad he didn't become an Adventist. He'd been a fantastic worker for us. But anyway, he became a Baptist. And he started working here in San Diego, and man, the church he worked with just grew. So this church in Modesto, the First Baptist Church there, it was called the Fightin' Fat Baptist Church, you know. And it wasn't the First Baptist Church, but the Fightin' Baptist Church. They'd run off the last three ministers. And they needed a new minister, and they heard about Yeager, and so they asked him if he would pastor the church. Well, he went there and reluctantly took the job. Within 10 years, over 2,000 people were going to that church every week. And, of course, everybody was wondering, how in the world did he do this? Well, they had a seminar, and so I went to the seminar to find out what he did. And what I found out was amazing. I found out that he had 26 pastors on the staff. Of the 26 pastors that were on the staff, 20 of them were homegrown. They'd just come right up to the church. And how did they grow? They grew because he had established small, steady groups in his church. He had over 70 Bible study groups in that church. I went to visit these groups. And oh, I'm telling you, it was exciting. And just like that light went on, I said, wow. If you could get these groups going into numbers, a pastor could pastor 20, 30,000 people and still pastor. Because what happens is that the pastor now becomes a rancher and not a shepherd. You know what the difference is between a shepherd and a rancher? A shepherd takes care of sheep. A rancher takes care of the shepherds. You know? So, if a pastor could somehow find people in his church that were completely dedicated to Jesus and help them to grow up so that they knew how to take care of the church, and then the church was broken down into little flocks, there'd be no end to what could happen to a church. You know? You could pastor a church of 20, 30,000, and still everybody in that church would be fed because there would be somebody taking care of them, caring of them, and nurturing them. That's the light that went in my head, and I thought, wow, I'm going to do this. So I went to see the conference president, and I told him my dream. I said, we're going to take the church that I was pastoring, and we're going to take this church, and we're going to turn it into I'm going to get these small groups going, and we're going to see dynamic things take place. And as I got through with my story, the conference president said to me, he said, Burton, there's no place in a Seventh-day Adventist church for people with dreams like yours. Boy, I'm telling you, was I upset. I went back to our church and I was determined, I'm going to do this. You know what happened? I got into all kinds of trouble. Now, the reason I got into trouble wasn't because I wasn't doing what God wanted me to do. It's because I really didn't know how to do it, you know. But I was going to get those groups off the ground. I wasn't able to get those groups off the ground in that church. Finally, I got almost had a nervous breakdown there. And I said, God, you're going to have to get me out of this situation. And he did. But I never forgot that this is the key. After a lot more learning, I went back and pastored a church just down over the hill here in Arlington. You know, I was going to take that church. We're going to revolutionize Riverside. I'm going to get these small groups going in that church. I knew about it. I even wrote a manual on small groups, man. I'm an author. Nobody bought the book, but I wrote it anyhow, you know. I know how to do it. I couldn't get it off the ground. Wonderful people. I'm telling you, the Arlington church was, you know, they treated us just royally. But it was almost like hitting a soft pillow. I couldn't somehow get the message through. They couldn't catch the vision. I look back on it, it was mostly my fault. God brought us down here. We worked for Academy of Christian Discipleships, and then finally we got a call. We went to Hawaii. I told my wife, you know, I was 62 years old. I said, you know, honey, I think maybe we ought to just retire. God made it clear he wanted us to go to Hawaii. We went to Hawaii, and all of a sudden, things fell into place. And all of a sudden, I began to realize what you have to do to get these off the ground. To make a long story short, we started with one group in Hawaii. In 3 years, we had 123 groups. And you talk about spiritual dynamics. Wow. I told you, if you want to retire someplace, retire in Hawaii. But boy, what a wonderful experience. We had this core group. Start on Tuesday. And I'm not going to share with you exactly all the dynamics, so I don't have time for that, but I just want you to know something. It can happen in an Adventist church. It can happen in this church. But there are certain things that have to take place. And if some of you folks would really like to know what those things are, I'd be more than glad to share them with you. But you have to talk to me about it and ask me. And if you do, I'll be glad to take some time and share it with you. But we had this core group. We became a family. Over in Hawaii, they call them Ohana groups, which means family. And it's not just a personal family. It could be a spiritual family. It could be a community family. But that's what we called it, Ohana. I like that name, don't you? Ohana, family. This group met with us every Tuesday for almost 3 years. We prayed together. We studied together. We played together. We had good times together. We just became a family. We supported each other in the tough times. And believe me, I don't care who you are, you're going to have tough times. And that family began to branch out and start other families. And it was through that family that we came up with 123 groups on the islands of Hawaii. You know what I've discovered about these small groups? Listen to this very carefully. Number one, these small groups is a fantastic way for us to grow. It helps us to grow up to the place where we become shepherds. And we could even become ranchers. And we need that in our church. Second thing that takes place is that it's a fantastic way to evangelize. Now, I believe in evangelism. I think we've got to let the world know about it. But you know what was interesting is when you looked at the record in Hawaii, and as you looked at it, you'd see that One year they'd be a big year, and you look at it, oh, Mark Finley came over and held meetings. Oh, that's why. Then the next year they didn't have enough money because it cost money for these evangelistic crusades. So next year it would be way down here. And then the next year it would be up like that. Oh, who? Oh, Ron Halverson was here. Oh, that's the reason. So then the next year, and this is the way it went on the schedule. Just like every other year they'd have big crusades. And they'd, you know, well, we decided, okay, we're going to go and we're not going to have any big crusades. We're going to take and put it into our people and help our people to grow so they can be what God wants them to believe. I'll tell you, folks, I believe in what we call the priesthood of all believers. You know that? That means all of us are called to be ministers in our own right. God has a place for every one of us. So we poured our money into our people. And you know what's interesting? You look at the baptismal record and here's the way it is. First year, second year, third year. That's the way it is. No drop. The people did it. September 8, 2001 was one of the most exciting days of my life. We went down to the ocean and eight people, four from my group and four from another one of our groups, were baptized. All of them came into the church as a result of our ohanas. This Blaine and Gurley Nueva, wonderful people. I'd like to get them here to share. But they started off their group. They were the first ones in Hawaii to start off, lay people, started off with a group. They started with seven church members and seven who were not church members. Within a year and a half, the score was 14 church members, none. Then they had to branch out, and now they got other people. And since then, they've baptized about another three people. Did it all through Ohana. It is exciting. It's the best way there is to evangelize. Can you imagine having small groups all over Fallbrook here, different places? It's easy. It's fun, exciting. But you've got to know how to do it. And we learned. Another thing is the best way I know of keeping people in the church. I don't know of any other way that is better than this. I'm telling you, these small groups hold people in the church. You know, they found out if you have... If a person, when they become a Christian, the devil runs down the road, maybe 3, 4, 5 months, just waits. They come running along, sticks his foot out like that, and people fall flat on their faces. And then the devil says, oh, you know what? If I were you, I'd never go back to that church. If they knew what you just did, they wouldn't want you. And besides, that church doesn't care for you at all. But we found out that if people have at least 8+ friends, chances are 95% of the chances is that they'll stay in the church. But if they have only 1 to 3 friends, the chances are that only 10% of those people will stay in the church and stay with Jesus. It's fantastic. And you know, it's interesting, and Mrs. White makes it very clear that this is the way we should go with our churches. I was amazed to discover that in the Bible here, it makes it clear too that that's how the early Christian church was built. It was built on small groups. That's why Constantine couldn't stamp them out. That's why pagan Rome couldn't get rid of the church, because these little groups were every place. That was it. They got together for big church services like this. But the core of the church was these small groups. Oh, there's a lot I could tell you about this, but just let me tell you something. I think we're heading into some very troublous times, and I believe that before Jesus comes back again, we're going to go back to small groups. You know, we read there in Mrs. White's writing that at the very end of time, in great controversy, it says, little groups of people will gather together worshiping. They won't have pastors like me or your, you know, any pastor. We'll have to worship together. And we have to become our own pastor. Folks, as I look back in the last 25 years, I can see that the Lord has been taking us step by step. I don't know how we're going to get this message to the world and to the church, but I know that small groups... it's God's ordained way of doing it. When people meet Christians, they desire to be Christ-like. And you do it through fellowship and friendship. So let me ask you a question. What kind of a boat has the Lord asked you to build? Second question, are you building on it still? I don't know what God has asked you to do. I know that when I retired, I told the Lord, I said, Lord, look, I'll do anything you want me to do. I'm yours. You guide me and direct me. And I know that he brought us here. I don't know all the reasons why, but we're here. But I know that God has put into our minds the idea that we have got to get our church back to what it was like in the book of Acts. How it's going to happen, I don't know. But it's going to happen. Because God has a master plan for this world. So what has God asked you to do? As we close this church service here today, think about it. Where are you at in your project with God? Are you still working on the boat that he's asked you to build, or have you put it aside because of things? You know, one day I had a week of prayer for one of our academies, and one week, I should say, and one of the talk was on this guy, Noah. And when I got all done, I asked the kids, I said, okay, how many of you folks here, how long would you work on that boat? And I gave them a little slip of paper, they could check it. I said, would you work a week, a year, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, 120 years? How long would you work on that boat? And one of the kids there wrote on this paper, I would work on that boat until somebody made me mad. You know? I think, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. The biggest problem we have today is that we get a vision of what God wants us to do, and we start working on the project, and the next thing you know, something happens, we get upset, and we say to ourselves, ah, this isn't worth it. It is worth it. Whatever God's asked you to do, it's worth it. I don't know what the boat is. I know, in our case, I feel the boat is to help us to get these small groups established in a church. I would love to see a church like this all of a sudden just explode. You could handle 20,000 people. I don't know how you put them in here, but, you know. But that's what it could happen if you did it right. And there's a way to do it. But what does God ask you to do? Well, as we close, I'm not going to have a specific call today. I'm just going to have a general call. What I'd like for us to do is take our songbooks and sing our closing song. I should ask Emily what the page number is, but I know it's 507 today. She said, you know, Pastor, you always sing, what's the page? You tell me the song, and then you don't even know what the song is. So it's 507. 507. And I'd like for us to stand, and we're going to sing this song together.